Blog Talk Radio.
Let's get lost in a better place. Pick up a bird, travel through time and space. So much to learn, so much to see. A chance to escape reality. Open your mind and your heart. Gain new knowledge for a fresh new start. They never will bring you there. So let's talk about it when life and on the air.
We are so triple live today. Yeah. What more can MJ Network ask for than having three outstanding authors here? And, well, the title may be Three Strikes, but they don't get three strikes, seriously. We've got Royce Clavin, Tim O'Mara, and Charles Salzberg, and the authors of this phenomenal novella that I read in less than zap time because I couldn't put it down, Three Strikes. Good morning, everybody. How you doing?
Good morning, Fran. Good to hear you.
Yeah, I'm here. And tell me something. How did you guys decide to write this? And, of course, the title says Three Strikes, and if you meet the main characters, you'll understand what that means. I'm not going to tell you. So how did you come to collaborate on this?
Kim, why don't you take that?
We should let say it because it's his responsibility. We blame him.
Or the blame, however you want to put it. A couple of years ago, Charles, Ross, and I had all written novellas for this company that was going to e-publish them out of California, and long story short, it didn't happen. The guy lost his funding. So I was familiar with Down and Out Books from Lutz, Florida, and I approached the publisher, Eric Campbell, and I said, look, we have three novellas. If we put them together, it would make a novel-sized book. And the way I explain it is, you know, before I could finish the question, Eric had already said yes. So we had three crime novellas. They're not related to each other. And we called it Triple Shot. And I think it was so much fun for the three of us. I know it was for me to get out of the novel form. So we decided to do it again. And we called it Three Strikes. And we have another one due in 2 years, which we haven't decided on yet what the title is going to be called. But it's going to be the three of us again. So we're going to have a trilogy of trilogies. So
this is good. I read Triple Shot. I reviewed that one. I did.
Yeah. And we spoke to you about it.
There.
I remember.
I did.
We
and then
to
I
you,
happened to see
years
this
ago
one.
About it. Yeah.
That's right. And then Cheryl just said to me, you're going to do this. They don't ask. Pontus and Grime just said, she's going to do this, and you're going to do an interview. And I go like, what? Okay. I don't even bother to argue anymore. I just say, yeah, okay, whatever.
Well, lucky you.
So,
you get three of us for the price of one. That's
I am excited. I was excited. This is like, I've done panel shows, Charles knows, but I've never done three authors with the same book. This is going to be hilariously fun. So
be careful how you phrase that now.
That's a threesome.
The title speaks for itself, and each of the main characters, when you get to know them, the title seriously fits. So Tim, we'll pick on you first.
Okay. Pick on me.
We have Aggie, and he's in trouble with his boss for not completing his shipment, which it was he really didn't know what the shipment was. So how did that happen? And now, why is he treated as a slave? Tell us more about him. I liked Aggie. I wanted him to punch his boss in the face. Seriously.
You know, I like Aggie, too. A good friend of mine read Jammed, which is the second one. The first one was Smoked. And she said, what I like about Aggie most is he's the dumbest smart guy I've ever met.
Mm-hmm.
And he's based on somebody in my life whose name will go unmentioned. But when you first meet Aggie in the first novella, he just comes across as, you know, nothing is ever his fault. The circumstances in which he finds himself, it wasn't my fault. And the first line, the first words out of Aggie's mouth are, I'm not going to lie to you. And anybody who's ever heard those words come out of somebody's mouth your first instinct is, this guy is going to lie to me. So in the first one, he's explaining himself and how he got into this situation. And the more he talks about it, the more I think he realizes it was his fault and there was a way out of it. And he had to make a major sacrifice. And in fact, when I wrote the first one, when I wrote Smoked, I actually pictured Aggie as walking out of this bar to his death. And then some people, some friends of mine said, you know, I really like this guy. Can you bring him back? And I'm like, God, I thought he was dead. I thought he was dead. And then I had to figure out a way why he wouldn't be dead, because what he did was... what he did in the eyes of his employees was certainly something that you get fired permanently for. So then he gets in jammed. He ends up, they need him to do a job. And he's got 48 hours to do it. And if he does it successfully, they'll be even. So he does. And again, stuff happens that is not his fault. And it makes the trip from Missouri to New York a lot more interesting. So.
Yeah, it does, especially the fact that they're tracking him every single step of the way. They
yes.
even gave
well,
him, they even limited how many times he could go to the bathroom. That would kill me. Forget
yeah,
that.
Yeah, they're not going to let him mess up again. Even though, again, the mess-ups the first time around were not completely his fault. You know, there's only so much you can do. If you're gonna smuggle cigarettes in a truck that was just used to hold a whole bunch of ammonium nitrate, terrorist sniffing dogs are going to pick up on that. So that's a little tip for your listeners. Yeah.
Everybody's listening. I've got people on my Facebook wall. I just choose not to answer them right now. No. Bartek is the first character we meet, and that's in the first story. And tell us, this was really scary. You placed him in the back of the club. So how did he come to be in such a dangerous situation? And then we learn more about him afterwards, sort of.
Right. Well, he's in the back of a car. I'm not going to give to the story away why he's in the back of the car, but he is a wounded. The story takes place in the 70s in New York City, and Bartok has been injured in the Army. He's never even gotten into combat. He's been blown up in a truck, and he's terribly scarred from the neck down. But his face is... He's enormously handsome from the face up, which is, you know, a problem for him. And when he was blown up, he had this incredible hallucinogenic transcendental experience, kind of an out-of-body experience related to his pain. And he goes about the entire book trying to recapture this weird experience, and it gets him into a lot of trouble.
Well, he's got this thing for women, too, doesn't he? He's got something to do with himself.
He lives in 70s New York, which, if you live there or have read much about it, it was covered in prostitutes, the entire city. If you stopped your car at a light during the summertime and your window was open, somebody would lean on the car door and offer you a date. So I wanted to get into that kind of swirling world that where normality and psychosis are kind of walking hand in hand.
I just thought there were a lot of friendly women around. I didn't know that.
There were friendly women around. They were very friendly as long as you paid them.
Yeah.
Charles refers to that time as the golden age of New York.
Yeah, exactly. And I find that, you know, that state where you feel like ordinary life is really unlivable and psychotic. I like to write about that state, mostly because I feel I'm holding on to my own sanity by my fingertips. So it becomes a very easy subject to write about.
How's that working out for you, Russ?
That's scary. That is so scary, which is why I write from the point of view of a dead body behind the gravestone to punish anybody that's ever gotten me angry. No, seriously. really.
Right.
Doesn't quite make it as famous as you. So, Charles, in your story, we meet Jake Carper, a young reporter who does not receive the respect and stories he deserves. So he attends a council meeting. He learns something from someone there that could be a big story. But why would they give it to someone else, and why didn't this person look closer? And you got to bring this guy back, so I've spoken.
And other people have said that, too. Well, you know, in any kind of business, and certainly in the news business, Ross knows this because he was a reporter, there's a hierarchy. And the big stories don't go to the young cub reporters. They go to someone who's experienced, and that's what happens to Jake. Is he's on to a story that might be a big story, so they give it to someone who's more experienced and who's sort of been on that beat. And of course, he's frustrated because he feels it's his story. But I think that's very common, probably in every business, where the last one in is the one who gets all the crappy jobs, and that's what happens to Jake. But he's very ambitious, so he's not very happy about that.
I wouldn't be happy either. But in the second story, we have Aggie. We have to pick on Tim a little bit more here.
Right.
Please.
And he's driving to New York, and he has a serious problem.
Yeah.
He doesn't know there's somebody else there. How did you decide to do that? That was hilarious. That was funny.
Yeah. Well, I've always been fascinated by the smuggling of legal products. So in the first book, it was cigarettes. In the second book, it's maple syrup. But I've also been, unfortunately, and take this for what it's worth, sex trafficking is something that's fascinating to me, that it takes place in America right now with not just foreign people from foreign countries, but also from America. So I wanted what happens is Aggie gets some unexpected company on the trip to New York, and it's not only uncomfortable, it's also it's illegal, and it once again becomes life-threatening. And honest to God, it wasn't his fault. It just kind of happened. And he's got from Illinois to New York to figure out how to handle this and come out on the other end alive. So I like that. I mean, all of any crime writer will tell you, Ross will tell you, Charles will tell you, the fun of writing crime fiction is just constantly putting obstacles in front of your hero or your anti-hero, as it were, and making them constantly think. Jeffrey Deaver referred to it as shattering your audience's expectations. So just when you think things are bad enough, now there's this. So that just keeps the reader going. And in a novella, if you can do that 3 or 4 times, you've got somebody's attention for about 3 hours, and it's almost like going to the movies. You're done. You can read jammed in 3 hours.
Well, I won't tell you how long it took me to read this book, because Charles knows I read everything, and I just sit down and read it. I won't even tell you how long it took me to read it. Not long, but well, it was good.
Right.
So we've got this girl in the back, and what's her purpose? She's not too smart. I wanted to, wise up, smack her in the head. What is wrong with you? I mean, she was doing something that was absolutely insane, and she didn't see it. Well, a lot of girls do that, so that's a good lesson for kids.
Well, I was going to say she has this very common malady that we refer to as being 16 years old.
Yeah.
And she has to make matters even worse, she's social media savvy. So as the father of a girl who's about to be 16 years old, I decided I wanted to write about that and how much trouble you can get into when you think you're talking to someone and you're really not talking, you're texting. You have no idea who you're talking to. And you think you do. 16-year-olds are known because nothing will ever hurt them. They're invincible. Until they're not. And Aggie knows this, but the young lady that he ends up driving to New York does not. And if something does happen to the young lady on the way to New York, his boss is not going to want to hear whose fault it was. It's just who was the closest grown-up when it happened.
Yeah, and they don't want to know who the child belongs to either. I wouldn't want to know either, to tell you the truth. I mean, that was kind of scary. So now we've got...
Yes.
My other friend over here, Bartok, and getting to know Bartok even more, he talks about returning to Red River. What is that? And what do these prostitutes have to do with his fate? he feels like if he doesn't get approval from them for being wonderful and lovely, and yet they make him feel like nothing, not all of them, some of them, why does he feel that he needs their accolades or their approval?
Now he's going to have to pay you for a therapy session, I think. That's.
I think I'm getting good at this, yeah. So tell you.
Yeah. Well, let me talk about Red River is the name he gives this odd transcendental experience that he has when he's blown up, because it's beyond language, and he tries to figure out a way to talk about it. And while he's in the military hospital, he's on morphine, and he's going in and out of consciousness, and they bring a projector into the ward, and they show these guys the old Western movie, Red River, which had John Wayne and Montgomery Clift. It's actually a pretty good film. Howard Hawks directed.
Mm.
And he gets these shards of information from the movie. And so he begins, but he hasn't seen the film. He just gets these odd shards of information that he puts together, and he begins to call the experience that he had Red River. So what he's doing, which I think most of us do, is take barely perceived elements of experience that we've had and sort of sew them together in what we think of as, you know, an outlook or a life, and then proceed along the way, somewhat blindly, but thinking we know where we're going.
He's sort of having his own lucid dream and making up the ending himself, or how he wants it.
Yeah, I don't know if it's how he wants it, but he's certainly constructing a world for himself. Yeah,
that's scary. Now, in the third story, we learn more about Elizabeth Chandler, which is the story that Jake has to write about her death. Why doesn't anybody care that this lady died? Because after all, this could turn out to be something a lot more than they think.
Right. Well, it's one of these human interest stories that young reporters get. There's a woman who has died alone. She's kind of a hermit up in a small cottage in upstate Connecticut, along with 20 cats. She had 20 cats, and she had no friends. The only outside contact she had were that there's a school nearby, a boys' school, and the boys sometimes came by and did errands for her. So Jake is sent up there to do a human interest story on this woman, Elizabeth Chandler, and he's not very excited about it because, you know, what kind of story is there about a woman who's, you know, been unsocial for most of his life? But he uncovers something about her that's very titillating, and that is that she had another name, or that's not her real name, and that she had another life, and that she was involved in a very well-known murder case. And actually, this is based on a true story, mm-hmm. Fran. There really was an Elizabeth Chandler, and there was really a Florence Maybrick, and that's the name of the story of the novella, is the Maybrick Affair. And so this is actually based on reality, and it's a story that was told to me by a friend of mine who was a reporter up in Connecticut.
It's too bad that we never found out if it's really true what happened to her husband, if he really was the person they think he was.
That's right.
That may put a lot of people's minds at rest because, you never know, he could still be around.
That's right. And that is also true, that in mm-hmm. real life, her husband was suspected of being this person that you're alluding to that we won't talk about because it's kind
of a
surprise in the book in the novella.
That just proves that Fran doesn't put spoilers in her shows, too.
Mm-hmm.
I try to be so careful. And, you know, you never know. So, okay, Tim, before you have to go, we're going to get you one more time. In story two, Aggie seems to get along with Charlene. You got to admit, this is hilarious. He's like a father to her. But then, out of nowhere, in a different truck, Missy shows up. So, what do these two pathetic kids do, and why don't their parents... Well, Charlene's father is crackers, and he's going to, you know, not happy. But Missy's parents don't really care about her. They won't even speak to her on the phone.
Well, that's one of the points I wanted to make in a humorous way, is that I think because of social media, parents are just as guilty as their kids sometimes, thinking they just believe that, you know, Missy's with Charlene. So that's what, you know, that's how we're going to do it. We're just going to assume Missy's telling us the truth and all is well with the world. And you know, I wanted to make everybody in the story is mm-hmm. guilty of something, even though you never see mm-hmm. Missy's parents. They're mm-hmm. guilty of believing what their daughter says. And you know, my parents never would do that. But if I was ever staying over mm-hmm. a friend's house, a phone call would be made.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they don't do that. They just trust Missy because it's easier. You know, and your listeners may not know, because you know not everybody's heard of me, but I taught in New York City for 30 years, and I've met the most oblivious parents in the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know why my son's not getting his homework done. We just bought him a 40-inch TV that he keeps in his bedroom. You know, I've heard stuff like that. And then you go, well, I know how my father would have handled that. So, yeah, I wanted everybody just, you know, it's like the perfect storm in a sense with Aggie.
Mm-hmm.
Aggie has to make up the mistakes that he made. And then these girls come along and they have their own agenda. And then when they get to New York, there's a group of people with their own agenda. And there's Aggie right in the middle, and, you know, things happen the way they happen. And I just, you know, nothing happens in a vacuum. And I love stories where if just one thing had changed, and life is like this, if just mm-hmm. one thing went differently, if one thing went
Tell
differently,
me about it.
The story wouldn't have happened, you know?
Well, I just want you to know, I read your Raymond Dunn series.
Oh, really?
I looked for the reviews the other day on my computer. I'm going, like, where did they go? Because I know I read Sacrifice Fly, and I know I read the rest of them, and I said, boy, can I identify. I taught in a tough school in the Bronx, and I'm little, and I never had a problem. And the parents knew better than to say, how come my child didn't have homework? You see, I had this method of printing out the homework every single day for every child. They never had to copy it, and I just handed it out. Put the book that you have to use, books that you have to take on your desk. Don't even tell me that you forgot. Didn't happen.
Right.
What can I say?
Well, if you couldn't find the reviews of the Raymond Dunn series, I could basically sum it up by saying they were spectacular mm-hmm. and all of them were positive.
They were. I wrote only positive things. I have a thing, and Charles knows too. I don't write negative reviews ever.
Right.
But there comes a time when some books are really that bad, and I will write a summary and tell the author I won't post it.
Yeah.
Except
well,
on my
I,
side,
I,
this is a summary. I won't do that.
It's funny, when Sacrifice Fly first came out, I was getting some nice
reviews
from the major folks, and then from Goodreads folks. And my favorite was that one guy actually hated the book so much he threw it across the room on page 58. He was very specific about what page he threw. So I go back to
Which
page 58
like?
And I go, I don't know why he picked that page. He could have easily thrown it at 27. But
in a way, that's kind of a reaction you hope for.
Yeah.
I
touched something in him.
Story, man, I have one review on Amazon where he got to page 146 before he did that.
Wow. So he was really
giving
you a chance.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
That's scary. So we've got Bartok. I really like this guy. I felt so bad for him. And those women were not very nice. And they were really, you know, dissing him. You guys got to be careful here. So tell us more about Regular Guy and why Bartok takes his frustration out on him. He really hurts a lot of people. How many people does he take his wrath out on? Because he's really, like, got a serious issue, you know, anger problem here.
Well, let's just say there are a number of murders that are committed before the
I
end
know.
Of the book.
Poor guy should have gotten away with them, too. I felt bad for him, you know, after all.
And
I think everybody should get away with something.
Absolutely. But I guess you get away with reading the book. But the regular guy is somebody who picks up Bartok in a bar while he's talking to a prostitute. And he seemingly is what Bartok nicknames him as, a regular guy. And then when he finally gets him up to a hotel, he finds out that he's really not a regular guy.
Yeah, I know.
And there's a major fight that ensues, and, you know, mayhem occurs.
Well, he was interesting, regular guy. So sometimes I think that Bartok is sort of going on wind power, that he doesn't really know what he's doing. And he's constantly saying, I want to go back to Red River. So that's scary, too. He doesn't seem to want to. His reality is what happened before. How come?
I think that Bartok is somebody who has either lost the ability to or has never had the ability to get to be with ordinary life, like the enjoyment of talking to you on the phone or having a sandwich, you know, or walking down the street. He's looking for some type of extreme experience, which is the only time he's ever really awakened to any kind of sensation.
That's scary. That is scary. Because sometimes he really doesn't. Yeah, scary, very scary. So wait a minute, let's go back to Jake. When Jake realizes that what he learns about Elizabeth, what would happen if he writes the story, and why would that infringe our policies with Britain? Why would it make it difficult for us?
Well, he takes out the Elizabeth Chandler. What happens in the beginning, he is told that a death of a night watchman months before, a night watchman in a brasswork's factory, might not have been an accident, that there might have been a foul play. And in investigating this this Elizabeth Chandler, which he thinks is a human interest story, he finds that there's actually a connection. There's an actual international connection, because what we haven't said is that this story takes place a few weeks before Pearl Harbor, and there's already World War II has started raging in Europe, and there's been a lot of pressure for the U.S. to get in the war before Pearl Harbor. Britain was trying to get the U.S. to come in on the side of the Allies.
I don't know if anybody else hears. I hear like an extra voice there somewhere.
Okay, yeah, we're getting a little interference.
I'm sorry.
We do. I hear somebody. I don't know where it's coming from either.
Okay, let me just.
It's not coming from my end. I don't know. There's like a lady talking. I can't.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah, I can hear you fine now. Yeah.
I'm in a cab. I'm going, like most writers, I'm on my way to therapy right now. So I'm gonna say goodbye. And thank you so much,
Tim.
You're very welcome.
Well,
we'll have to do this again when you write your next Raymond Dunn book. I hope you're writing another one.
I'm working on one now. It's called The Hook.
Good, and I want it before everybody else gets it, because that's just my deal here. Sorry, that's just me.
I'll see what I can do about that. Okay.
Okay.
Thanks
thank
very
you
much,
very,
guys.
Very much.
And you. Thanks. Bye.
Okay, Russ, we're going to pick on you now.
Anyway, Fran, so there's a lot of pressure to get the U.S. to come into the war on the side of the Allies, and there's a connection between the Maybrick situation and this pressure, and I don't want to say much more about it, but that is the connection about the U.S. coming into the war.
Well, he goes into her house after she dies, right? And he chances it. So what does he find that he finds there? And if he allows this thing to come out, that would change history. What a pity.
That's right. Well, what he finds after looking around, he kind of breaks into her house. He doesn't have permission to go in there.
I thought that was cool.
Yeah, and he finds some old photographs, and he finds an old newspaper clipping. And the old newspaper clipping alludes to this murder case in England years earlier, around the turn of the century almost. And he wonders why she's keeping this article. What could it possibly mean to her? And that leads him further on the case. And what he does is he finds that someone was supporting her. She was getting money every month, and he traces that. You know, that's what they say: follow the money. And he traces and he finds a lawyer for the estate, and that leads him to some other things. So that's what he's doing. It's very much what a reporter does, which is just follow leads. And of course, he has no idea till at a certain point he realizes that this woman is not who she pretended to be, that she's someone else. And it's understandable why she didn't use her real name.
Well, I can understand that, too. And I wonder what would have happened if he found out all of this stuff and she was still alive. That
right.
might have been interesting. I don't know.
Very. And now, other stuff I was all made up. I mean, the brass works murder and all that. I mean, what wasn't made up was that there was a real Elizabeth Chandler who was really this Maybrick character, and who really was the focal point of a notorious murder trial in England around the turn of the century. So all that was true, and the other stuff is made up.
That's amazing that people live there and nobody really recognized it until he brings it out, whatever. So
Right. Let's
get back to my friend Bartok, who can't seem to get a job, can't seem to get a girl, tries his very best, the poor thing. And what could you do? So who is Florette and who is Platoon? And I didn't like him. Her, I'm not sure about.
Well, first of all, I think with Bartok, as a character in a... Yeah, as a character in a noir novel, a novella, you have to hook into the idea that failure is more interesting than success, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So he basically, excuse me, friends. Whoops. He basically, we don't have a mic button. He basically fails at most of the things he's after and thinks he's really connecting. You know, the more you think you're at your destination, the more you're slip-sliding away, which is basically what happens to him. Florette is the woman, she's a prostitute, fairly expensive one, who he meets in a bar and sets him up for a crime because she realizes that he's a sap and he's out of his mind at this point.
Mm-hmm.
I think the whole aura of chaos in New York at that time was really an inviting idea, having actually covered it as a reporter. So
that is strange. But he seems to be, delusional at times. And at times you hear him talking and he's not really focused in where he is. He just seems to be going into the past all the time.
That's right. And
seriously, it's scary. He scared me at times. What can I say?
Well, that's good. Then it was a successful novella, I think.
Yeah, I told you I'd get
also,
it.
And you did. The story itself is told in the present by a guy who is a driver or was a driver for the mob, and he's driving Bartok to his final destination. And the guy is now telling the story as he would say if you met him in a bar and tells you this story. So there's a kind of weird intermixing of the past and the present converging on one another.
So basically, we're listening to this person tell the story as it really happened before, and he's just telling it to us.
Right.
And this is interesting, really interesting. I'm sorry that Tim isn't here, because that's okay. I got a whole bunch more questions for you guys. That was interesting, though, because at one point I said, well, let me go back to the beginning to make sure that I have this right. There's somebody else, there's like different voices telling the story in this particular case.
Yeah, and it's told at different times. It's like if you're talking to a friend and they're telling you something that happened to them and you're very locked into the story emotionally and you sort of live through it with them as they tell you, that event happens on all kinds of different levels all at once. And that's what I was trying to lock into.
At times, he doesn't even know where he is. He thinks he's somewhere else. That's scary.
And not uncommon.
I know.
Even for a moment, how often do you, every once in a while, you'll come out of a subway stop, in New York at the, you know, at a stop you haven't been at in a long time, and you can't quite, you don't quite know where you are for a moment. You know, that kind of momentary madness can be extended if you're writing a book.
I get you. Sometimes I walk around the corner and go like, what street is, no.
Absolutely.
I did that when I was teaching for a long time, and I go like, wait a minute, I know this is the front show, but, and they said to me, you know where this is? I go like, no, I've been here for 36 years and I didn't know that street existed. Some streets
you know,
I don't want to know existed where I worked. So it was dangerous, but we get through it.
To be serious for a moment about that, because I experienced that truly, is that I was
on
a train, and I was up, going up to Sarah Lawrence, where I was teaching, and I don't know what it was, but suddenly I had no idea where I was, why I was any place, why I was going there, and it was almost like muscle memory that I got off at the right stop and walked in the right direction, and I don't know whether it was kind of a brain thing or whatever, but it is incredibly scary. You know, we talk about it as a joke, it's sort of like being in a fog. But if it ever happens to you, it must be like what people who experience or the beginnings of dementia or Alzheimer's must feel that, and it is incredibly scary. Fortunately, I you know, overcame it after a while, but it's a really, it's a true thing. And if it happens to you, it's very disconcerting, and you know, I don't wish it on anyone. So I can only imagine.
I understand
imagine,
what you're saying.
Like,
my mother did. My mother had Alzheimer's, and we were. It was scary. She was driving, because I don't drive, because it's not safe on the road to have me drive. Forget it. And she parked the car, and she said, "What am I in?" I go, "Ma, this is your car. Are you very sure that I know where to go?" And I was so scared, because I'm saying, I said, "Ma, you just parked in front of the diner. We're going to have breakfast." "Oh, yeah, that's where I am." And about 20 minutes later, she said to me, "I can't remember why I'm here." I know, this is not good. Yeah, she had no clue. And basically, she had the Alzheimer's for 9 years. She stayed alive. And she was pretty alert for some of it. But after a while, I told my sister and my brother, we got to hide the car keys.
Yeah.
Because,
I mean,
you're
able
scary.
To see it develop, Fran, and it must be really scary. And at first, you think they're joking, you know, the first time it happens. And then you realize they're not. I had a friend, and I was in the car with him, and suddenly he didn't know where you know, we were driving around looking for a parking space, and he didn't know where he was. It was right near his home. And I thought he was joking at first, and then I realized this is the beginning of dementia, and sure enough, he did wind up with it.
My mother
had
dementia also.
Ever. Oh, it's scary, Ross, let me tell you.
Ross has some personal experience with that too, right, Ross?
Yeah, my mother died of dementia and alcoholism, which she added on to the dementia. And it was, I have to say, a very impressive experience to watch somebody's personality disintegrate like that. Frightening at a level that you couldn't quite touch a lot of times. And I think that the by the end of it, you were dealing with them on their fantasy world, because that's the real world to them. So you can't convince them out of it, you know, and don't try anymore.
No, as a matter of fact, they came in one day, and my sister, right before she passed away, I was like, oh, my God. She walked in, and my sister said to her, "The good one is here, her." And my mother said, "You look like a hooker walking down the street. It's time for you to leave and go upstairs and change." She used to say that to me all the time. You know, "I don't like what you're wearing." And they go like, how would you even remember that? I mean, there were days that she was, you know, coherent, and then there were days that she would look at me and say, like, "I know you're somebody, but I don't really care." And you have to have a sense of humor, because I never knew. I mean, you never knew what she was going to say or what she was going to do. And she would say to me, "Your father's inside. You're going to get punished." I go, "I never got punished. I never did anything wrong." But, you know, you just and then she would crack up laughing. I mean, she was in the hospital once, and she cursed out the nurse because she didn't do something fast enough. And she said to me, "That was bad." I said, "No, Ma, that was hilarious, personally." So, yeah, that could happen. So but Bartok, every time what happens that changes his fate, each time he gets angry, he reminds us about his experience in the Army. He can't seem to stay in reality. Why? Then we're going to get back to Jake.
I think that what he finds or what he has determined from this experience is that life is based in pain, instead of, you know, he says he comes up mm-hmm. with the idea that instead of original sin, there's original pain, and everything proceeds from there, and we tend to hurt and then either deal with it or lie about it. And that's the conclusion he comes to after the series of experiences, and he then attempts to recreate this one hallucinogenic experience that he had, this one transcendental moment.
That's scary. Now we go back to Jake, and he decides that he's going to write this story, but how does his safety become impacted? Because after a while you realize maybe you don't want to do that, Jake. It's not exactly safe, and of course his boss doesn't want him to write it.
Right. It's because of these international implications that he stumbles across that he doesn't realize mm-hmm. in the beginning that there's this connection between the Brassworks accident, which is may or may not be an accident, and this Maybrick affair. And so it does get a little dangerous for him because mm-hmm. there are people who stop this story, and it has to do with as you were intimating. It has to do with the negotiations between America and Britain to come into the mm-hmm. war were so fragile that anything could break it up, and mm-hmm. they were afraid that there would be some kind of international incident that would somehow break down the negotiations. And again, this is before Pearl Harbor. After Pearl Harbor, there was no question that we were getting into the war. And so there were very powerful people who wanted to stop Jake from pursuing this story, mm-hmm. so that tip over the canoe and ruin the negotiations. So that's the danger in it, and he doesn't realize that until later on.
But before I forget, because I don't want to forget, Monday we have the author of Napa Noir. And on Wednesday, we have my first time ever interviewing somebody that wrote a graphic novel, Howard Shapiro, another wonderful one from Partners in Crime, Criminal Misdeeds. And then this is really exciting. Besides you three guys that really excited me, the 25th, we've got Carlin Eggers, Impostor's Law, somebody that you know and I love. And also on the 30th, somebody that you know and love, Bruce Coffin, Beyond the Truth. And on the 1st, someone else that you both love, James Heyman, Fatal Obsession. And that's just the next couple of weeks.
If you have a minute, I have a very funny story about Jim Heyman. I met Jim when he took when I was leading a pitch conference, and this is years ago, and he hadn't published a book yet. And he came to the pitch mm-hmm. conference, and we became friendly. And I also have a friend by the name of Diane Flynn. And Diane Flynn was for years in the advertising business, and as was Jim. And at this point, Jim was retired and living up on a small island up in Maine. And a summer or two after that, after this pitch conference, Diane spent a month up in Maine on this small island. And she's taking the ferry back to the island after being on the mainland for a while. And she gets off the ferry, and she starts to walk to her house, and a car stops, and someone sticks their head out and says, "Would you like a ride?" And it was Jim Hayden, who she knew.
Oh, God.
And started chatting, and somehow it came out that Jim knew me, and Diane was a best friend of mine. So it's one of those small world stories of, and that's how I know Jim, and that's how, I became friendly with him, and this was before he published his first crime novel. So I'm excited. So say hello to him for me when you speak to him, when you interview him.
Well, you know what I did. I was going over to Bruce Coffin to say, "Where's my copy of Beyond the Truth?" And then James was sitting next to him. I said, "Wait a minute, how come I never reviewed your book out of nowhere?" And my husband's looking at me and goes, like, "Only you would do that." And I go, "Well, how come I didn't review your book?" And he handed me one. He says, "While you're at it, we're going to have another one." And I read The Cunning. Oh, my God, was that good. That was really good. And Fatal Obsession just proves that there's girl power in the world. That's all I'm going to say. It's absolutely fantastic. But if you guys want to know what to read, I would read everything by Russ Clavin and Charles Salzberg, and I would read Three Strikes. I just finished, and with that time, Field of Bones by J.A. Jantz. I liked it. Button Man, of course, by Andrew Gross was fantastic. And I just was so honored that Stephen James said he would interview me, the last one for 2018, Every Wicked Man. That was scary. And the one and only, one of my favorite people, Flower Man by Vincent Zandri. He's coming on November 20th and December 17th for his Chase Baker series. What more can a girl ask for? What can I say? So
it's fantastic.
We've got another 15 minutes. And how did you decide the theme or the storyline for your stories? And yet each one of these characters has flaws. So how do they all intersect? So in a sense, because they all sort of blended together, even though they were different characters in different ways, they all had their own strikes against them. So how did you decide that?
Among the three of us, you mean?
Yeah.
We actually rarely talk to one another. Although Charles and I have a weekly lunch scheduled, at which we talk about Tim. Yeah. We miss Tim at the lunch.
Every week. Ross is one of my best friends, and I just want to assure the audience that he's not as dark as his character seems. You know, it's not like sitting in a therapy session. We actually have a great time, or we wouldn't do it every week.
And it was great to put the three books together without knowing what the other one was writing, knowing only that it was going to be having something to do with the three of us. And it always works.
Well, actually, it does sort of link together, even though you didn't know that, but it does sort of blend together if you look at it real carefully, like me.
Well, I think what you said before, that all the characters have three strikes against them, I think
that's
true.
Yeah, they do.
That's very, observant on your part. And our next one will be out in, what, 2 years?
Two years in the fall. I have a new swan coming out in mid-May.
Oh, well, then that I have to know. These are the things that I have to know because Dick Belsky, and D.P. Lyle are coming on in May. You see, they didn't know I already have the books. I got them all. And I was like, where did this come from? And they go, yeah, you got it. They didn't even know it. They don't have the book. I do. So,
well,
it's doesn't matter.
As soon as I get
when
the arc,
when in May.
Send it to you.
Well, I have to get it so I can fit you in.
May 20th.
I'm doing May 20th?
Yeah, May 20th. Yeah, May 20th is the pub date.
Let me look at my calendar.
So,
I have a.
So
I keep my
calendar. I can do something in June. Yeah, sure.
Anytime. This is good. Okay, good. I'm going to stick you right in my phone right now. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, or Thursday.
Any day. It doesn't matter to me.
Okay, I'm going to put it in for June 5th. That's good.
Okay.
And I'm going to do it right now so that I don't forget. And then when you get the name of the book and all the summaries and stuff, then I could put it in. And probably, are you guys coming to the Thriller Fest so I could wave at you again? I'll be back if that's what they invite me.
Here,
that's what they tell me to come.
Yeah, this year I may well go, friend, because I've been writing for their magazine every month called The Big Thrill. And so I know so many people now, I may just sign up this year. Usually I get there one day and just have lunch with people that I know.
Yeah, I didn't see you last time.
Yeah. Well, because I only go for, like a couple of hours. By that time I'm sort of conferenced out. So, but this year I actually sign up.
It's very nice of them because I do all their reviews, most of them, and Kimberly invites me every year, and so does John Land. So I only have to basically deal with the hotel, and it's a lot of fun. And, of course, I was one of the people that stood online for 45 minutes to meet George Martin because my niece wanted his autograph.
Oh, boy, that line was so long.
It was ridiculous. And then I got really upset because I said to him, I heard you're coming out with a book. Would you like me to review it? And he looked at me like I had four heads. And somebody said, you really want her to do that? And I go, whatever, that's okay. I felt like, whatever, it's okay. George, I'm really good at what I do. What can I tell you? So, before we go, if Bartok could speak out, what would he tell readers about his journey in life, and would he change anything? We're not going to tell anybody about the ending. That's not good.
I think that he would, it would be a long, guttural outcry for help, and that he would change everything
mm-hmm.
and live his life completely differently.
Well, I have a question for you, Rusty. Will you revisit Bartok, do you think?
I don't think I'll revisit Bartok, but I am toying with the
mm-hmm.
idea. I've made a lot of notes for revisiting the narrator who has
oh, nice.
Had a number of these stories. Yeah. And I think that one of the things that you can do with that double voice is that the narrator's voice ameliorates
mm-hmm.
the darkness a little bit. Otherwise, I think you'd, you know, read the book and head for the bar.
No, I agree. I would do that, too. And, Charles, are you going to bring Jake back? Because he's really a good character. You might want him to meet Swan. Who knows?
Well, it's funny you should say that, Fran. Because
good idea.
My editor, Lance Wright, read it, and this is months ago, and he wrote me, and he said, Charles, are you planning to revisit Jake again? Because I really like the
I
character,
like
and I'm curious we'll like him, too. And my answer, my initial answer was, are you kidding, Lance? It takes place in 1941. I'd actually have to do research, and you know how lazy I am, and so, but that planted the idea in my head, and then I've always wanted to write. I'm fascinated by Nazis. I read everything that has
mm-hmm.
to do with Nazi Germany, and I realized that there were, and I grew up very close to it. There were in Yorkville. There were a lot of Nazis, you know, American Nazis.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them were born. And so I might even do the next novella that's due with Jake getting involved in Nazis right around the time that the U.S. goes into the war. I'd still have to do some research, and I really am lazy, so we'll see if it...
I love doing research. It's my favorite thing. My niece is going to nursing school, and I create the questions for her test. I've got three huge books of 2,000 pages each, and she says, would you read these chapters and make the questions, and then research it so that I get... She aced the test yesterday because of my brilliance, she said. So,
well, I don't know.
I don't know how to do it, but I do it. I just make it up.
But your listeners probably don't know this, Fran, but what she does, listeners, is that she, well before we go on the air, she sends us,
yes.
all the people that she interviews, like 2 pages full of questions.
Yep,
and
I do.
This woman is amazing. She reads so many books a week, yet you can see the real teacher in you, Fran, that you do that, that she puts together these questionnaires that are so, you know, you can tell she's read the book and really thought about it, and multiply that by how many books do you read a week, Fran?
It depends. This week I'm a little slow, maybe 5 or 6, but I start like 10 at one time. You have to blame my mother for that. My mother made me read 6 to 10 books a week, yeah, and then she made me take notes. I still do. You should see how your book looks, because I wrote in it, I have dog ears, I circle things, I write U's, and then I go back and I have the book memorized. I don't even have to look at the book before I write it. And then I have this little notepad on my phone that I just, as I'm reading the book, I write the book review on my phone, and then I email it to myself. It's my mother's fault, yeah. She did. And then when I went for my reading master's, there was a professor that taught me how to look past what's on the page and look deeper in it. So,
mm-hmm.
yeah. I learned a lot, and then I guess I try to figure out what each one of you were trying to say. Because just to say this book is about, no one's going to hear. They have to understand. And by the way, there's about 10 people that have asked me for the book, and I told them to get it on Amazon.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you.
They're not getting it. So if Jake could speak to everyone, what would he say before we go? We have about 5 minutes. What kind of a reporter does he want to be? And if you decide to, you know, bring him back and go into the bed, well, you could always make Swan go back in time, too, if you like. But
I don't do time travel.
What would he say?
Well, you know, this was well before Woodward and Bernstein, but I picture him as someone who would have liked to have been, if he'd known who Woodward and Bernstein was. That's the kind of reporter he would like to be. And oddly enough, if he were around now, if he were a young reporter now in the times that we're in now, he would relish what's going on now, because I think there's a rebirth of investigative reporting now, what with the politics being what they are. And so I think that he'd be very excited about being in on the action. So that's how I picture him, as one of these guys who, you know, he's Ivy League educated, and he really he likes research too, and he likes finding answers. And so that's how I would describe him.
Is he going to stay with Maggie? I have to know. This is love interest.
I don't know. I haven't thought about it.
Maybe I better ask him.
She's very supportive of him, so I think probably yes.
Okay, so before we go, where can we learn about you? And Ross, are you writing a single, a standalone or anything that I haven't read? Because I haven't read your book so far. This is not good.
I am working on something that I can't talk about. I have something coming out in an anthology about old radio in January.
Oh, nice.
And it's sort of a follow-up to my novel entitled Schmuck that came out a couple years ago.
Have you read
that?
You should read that novel, Schmuck. It's really good, and it's based on partially on his father, who was a very famous radio personality. So if you get a chance, you should get a copy of Schmuck and read it.
Yes, he's not the title
character, by the
way.
My uncle's real last name was Schmuckle, and he went to court, and the judge's name was Schmuck, and he couldn't change it. No, I'm serious.
Wow.
Seriously, yeah.
Well, you should have at least changed it to Schmiegge or something like that.
No, that's what they used to call me. No, not really. But where can we find out about all you and your work before we go? We have about 3 minutes before the box says whatever. I don't listen to the clock.
I think Google us online is good. Go to Amazon.
Yeah, I have a website, charlesalzberg.com. And then we're both members of New York Writers Workshop, so you can go to that website and learn about us as well.
You said you're reading. Are you reading somewhere this week, or somebody else is reading?
Actually, Tuesday I'm going to be reading at KGB Bar, 1 o'clock, for Mystery Writers of America. They have a monthly reading series, and I'm also on the board of the local board of Mystery Writers of America. But yes, I'm reading. I'm one of I think 5 readers, and I'll probably read something new that I've been working on, maybe a short story. I just placed a short story. I just sold a short story to a magazine called Mystery Tribune that'll be out soon.
Well, all I did recently, and I didn't realize it, Andrew Gulley is Strand Magazine. And he sent me a copy of Strand Magazine, and he asked me to, I was honored, to review the story about Ernest Hemingway, that he wrote a short story. And he actually, I don't know where they put it. He asked me for the link to where I put it. I don't know if he put it in the magazine or whatever, but I was on it because he thought what I wrote was fantastic, so that made me feel good.
Oh,
I've
great.
Never done that before.
Very good.
I would love to write for a magazine. Besides the fact that MJ Magazine is going to come out, that's my magazine, issue MJ 11, and we're looking for writers of all ages. So if anybody wants to submit something, let me know. I've got children from ages 9 and up. And adults writing for the magazine. I want it to be writers of all ages, so people could see that there are young people that actually write.
Tell them where they can
find
the magazine online.
And where can they get the magazine?
On Amazon.
It's
called MJ Magazine by Fran Lewis, and MJ stands for my sister Marcia Joyce, who died, who started this. And I figured to keep her alive, I made my network MJ Network and MJ Magazine, and she's the one that dared me to review my first book, which was a cookbook, and I don't cook. Ever. I don't even know what a stove looks like, and the person whose book review it was is still laughing, and it went viral, and out of nowhere I got famous, I got popular. And I have to thank Tess Gerrinson, who's coming on the show November 14th to talk about her new movie Island Zero, just for me. First I have to be brave enough to watch it. And she was the first New York Times author that I ever interviewed, and she gave me a chance, so I was really honored, and she's amazing.
Well, thank you very much.
Sounds good.
Thank you so much for today, everybody. I think the sun is shining.
The sun is coming out. The
tomorrow.
Mist is burning off. Yeah.
The sun is shining. I'm in upstate New York. You're in New York down in the city. And if you're ever anywhere near, let me know. Okay, everybody,
Absolutely.
Have a great day. Have a great day.
You too.
And bye.
Thanks,
you're welcome.
Fran.
Thanks, Charles.
Bye.